I've heard podcasts you people wouldn't believe. And that's all I've got. I'm not going to talk about WGA and Oscar nominees battling near the shoulder of Orion. I'm just not gonna. Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith, and this is the Q&A. My agenda is simple. Each week, I plan to bring you in-depth insight into the creative process of storytelling. Man, oh man, have I wanted to do a podcast like this forever. Today, we have co-writers Hampton Fancher and David Webb Peoples with us to chat about 1982's Blade Runner. These guys have fantastic stories to tell about the stressful but collaborative process for making a true film classic. At certain points, we even get into some lost scenes that were scripted but never shot. And while yes, we discuss them, fear not, you could actually read excerpts of these scenes in Backstory Magazine, because Blade Runner 2049 is our cover story, and I did in-depth retro pieces with Hampton and David about their experiences too for the magazine. I gotta say, I truly admire all the hard work and thought they put into making this wildly original film, and the enthusiasm they had for talking about it with us in the podcast, so I know you're gonna dig this episode. I also want to take a moment to thank our sponsors, Screencraft and Final Draft. The fine folks at Screencraft.org hosts the annual Screencraft Screenwriting Fellowship, which is one of the industry's top programs for celebrating emerging writers and launching screenwriting careers. In fact, all of last year's winners signed with Hollywood managers because Screencraft offers winners the opportunity to mentor with Academy Award-winning screenwriters and producers, as well as studio executives, agents, and managers. This year's fellowship opens for applications on October 10th, 2017, and you could enter any and all Screencraft.org writing programs and competitions in 2017 and 2018 with this exclusive 10% discount coupon code QA Podcast. All one word, QA Podcast. And you will save 10% on your screenwriting program or competition entry at screencraft.org. Remember, Screencraft is dedicated to helping screenwriters and filmmakers succeed, so check out screencraft.org to learn more about them. As for our other fine sponsor, Final Draft has been the number one selling screenwriting application in the world for over 25 years. They are the geniuses behind the screenwriting software that automatically formats scripts to industry standards, allowing writers to do what they do best, tell stories. Final Draft is the professional's choice and the industry standard used by Oscar-winning filmmakers ranging from James Cameron to Aaron Sorkin and beyond. Their newest release, Final Draft 10, offers great new features like the Beat Board and Story Map that help you build your story from the ground up. Final Draft also offers reader and writer apps for the iPhone and iPad, making creativity truly portable. And the good news here is that Final Draft has been kind enough to offer a 30% discount off your purchase for listeners of this podcast. You can use this code over at www.finaldraft.com and use code QA Podcast, all one word, QA Podcast, at the checkout to save 30% off your screenwriting software purchase. So make sure to check out all they have to offer at finaldraft.com. And lastly, speaking of things to dig online, I hope you'll check out my digital magazine Backstory on the iPad. It is the place to go for amazing television, film, and theater content. And yeah, not only do I love the original Blade Runner, I really dig Blade Runner 2049 as well, and that is why the issue 29 cover happens to be Blade Runner 2049, and I cannot wait for you to be able to read it. And don't worry, folks, you will be able to read every single issue of Backstory over at backstory.net very soon, because our servers have been transferred, and now we're just in final testing, and it's looking pretty awesome, so stay tuned. Not only does issue 29 have great retro pieces on the original Blade Runner, you could also read in-depth Hampton Fancher and Michael Green interviews on the new Blade Runner 2049, of course. Issue 29 also features articles on the hit horror film It, actor Jason Isaacs talking about being the captain on Star Trek Discovery, actor-writer Danny McBride and director David Gordon Green on TV's Vice Principals, and so much more. So thanks for checking out issue 29. But now, without any further ado, on behalf of our sponsors, Screencraft.org and FinalDraft.com, I invite you to jump onto the stage at the PAX screening at the Los Angeles Film School right after I introduce co-writers Hampton Fancher and David Webb Peoples to discuss writing their sci-fi classic, Blade Runner. Jump right into it. Hampton, I know that before you actually had the rights, that you...
I never had the rights.
Right. Before they were acquired for you, that you had met with Philip K. Dick once.
Twice. Three times.
Okay.
Tell us about just any
kind of shit
that doesn't know anything. Tell us about the memories you have about meeting with Loki that you told me.
You're talking about memories?
Yes. Implants and memories.
I don't know. What do you want to know about him? He was crazy. He was probably a genius, and not one that interested me too much. You know, I wasn't a reader of Dick. I could read my Dick now, though. In 1975 is when I met him, and you know, he wasn't Philip K. Dick then. He was just this crazy burr-headed guy out in Pomona, you know, and living in a shitty apartment with a baby and a wife. And he was very intelligent, and I knew that. And he was kind of, you know, he was a raconteur. He was like, he went on and on. He was like, there was no oxygen except his. And I don't think he liked me very much, but I met with him 3 times. Is that enough?
Why do you think he liked you, just out of sheer curiosity?
Because he assumed... that, I mean, he was naive about Hollywood, and he thought I was a player, you know, and I was anything but, and still I'm not there. But, I mean, you know, not just out of choice, but because I just, you know, it never worked out for me too well. Like David here, you know, he's a big Hollywood guy.
You always had a beautiful woman with you.
You gotta use your bad name.
You always had a beautiful woman.
Well, just 3 times.
Yeah, just 3 times.
You gotta have a beautiful woman when you go to see Dick. What else?
I know that, kind of skipping forward on the trail of the rights, that at a certain point your friend had acquired them for you, and by that point you were kind of done with the project.
Not for me. I thought that I just sent him on this fishing expedition because he needed to fish, but I didn't want anything to do with the fish.
And I think the most interesting part of the story is that it was actually the actress Barbara Hershey, who you were dating at the time, talked you into coming back to Blade Runner when you were gonna leave. Tell us about it.
There was in the first place, but Barbara Hershey last night went with me to see Blade Runner 2, and she had also gone with me to see Blade Runner 1, and I'd met him already before, but we was at the Academy, I think on Wilshire, in big theater. And, you know, a lot of everybody, you know, the hoi polloi was there of Hollywood. And, you know, I'm taking photographs, paparazzi. And at one moment, I pushed Barbara close to David. And then I told one of those paparazzi
guys. Hollywood
Reporter. That's, huh?
Hollywood Reporter.
Hollywood Reporter. So that's Samson Fancher and Barbara Hershey.
But you were done, and the phone call came through that the rights were acquired, and she talked you into it, yes?
No, my friend had acquired the rights, Brian Kelly, my partner. And, I mean, not sexual partner. But, you know, so he was looking, I mean, he thought I could do that. You know, make the movie work, I mean, turn it into a movie. I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm not interested. I don't like the project. And, you know, I did for a commercial reason, the idea of producing it, but not writing it. I would not have produced it either, but that's what kind of happened. Barbara, I hung up on him once. She was making a film in Coronado with a stuntman, and I was with her, and it was nighttime. And she, before she was going off to shoot, she heard the tail end of my conversation with Brian Kelly. Is this interesting?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. You'd have to say, yeah. You'd just be stone-faced, no. Anyway, so she said, what the fuck are you doing? You thought you could do this film because it would put you through the front door of Hollywood and all that stuff, and you'd have a career and all that, and then you're saying, no, you're crazy. And blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, you don't know. And finally, you know, she had to go shoot. And I was left alone in the suite. And took out some stationery and started.
And the rest is history. You know, there's lots to talk about, but I know we're somewhat limited on time tonight. But the book itself, and we're going to get to good old David in a moment, but the book itself, obviously, two of the elements that fans have always asked about over the years is the use of Mercerism and, of course, Buster Friendly and his friendly friends. And I'm curious, in your early drafts, how prominent those two elements were that eventually left the script and left the film.
Yeah, He already knows the answer to this. We discussed it on his phone. you know, yeah, okay, I use Buster Friendly.
Talk about the importance of Buster Friendly.
I don't know if it was very important because it didn't stay, did it?
Buster Friendly,
I hated those guys, the Johnny Carson, all those people, you know, I didn't like that.
Buster Friendly was a talk show host.
Exactly.
In the book.
Yeah. And so Buster Friendly, in desperation, the character of Deckard, who was a little more innocent in that first draft that I did, he went to Buster Friendly thinking that if he could get to him, Buster Friendly might give some answers to his confusion that he was going through, but his moral dilemma of doing what he was doing. This is, I think, halfway through the film script. And so he got into Buster's dressing room because of his credentials as a cop, and asked Buster these frightening questions for him. And Buster said, "Just give me a second." And when he said, "I got to piss," and he went to the bathroom, and then he unzipped his fly, and a machine came out and gave him the answers. You know, blood ticker tape, and he went back in and told him. You know. So I thought that, I mean, things like that I was doing. Was that in the script you read?
No. No, David. You know, just to include David a second here, before you came on, David, and we'll talk to your story of coming on, I just want for both of you to give just your first impressions of working with Ridley Scott. So David, you could start, since you haven't said anything yet, but... We'll start with the other.
I just did all this shit. Come on. Now.
I only came on the picture after Hampton threatened to punch with me.
And we'll get to that.
Okay, so you got to go there first.
All right, then we're going to go sequentially, Hampton.
I didn't threaten to punch him. I said, "Get off the fucking chair and stand up. And let me beat the shit out of you, motherfucker." I didn't threaten to punch him.
You could tell they needed a new writer.
And then Michael Dealey said, "I told you he wasn't mature enough for this."
If I recall right, the argument, I've had many an argument with friends of mine about Blade Runner, but you were getting to have one with Ridley Scott. The argument pertained to the use of a unicorn for Sebastian, right?
Well, I had a little tiny, like a teddy bear unicorn, and in one of the final drafts, as a way to getting into Tyrell's. But that wasn't really arguments. It was just, it really has a, I mean, if you said that you don't like these shoes, and I say, "Well, but these shoes are kind of nice, they're like kind of deerskin or something, and they're beautiful, they're soft, they're inviting, blah, blah, blah." He said, "Yeah, but I don't want them." I said, "Yeah, but look at them, try them on." "Yeah, you're right, they're kind of nice, you know, but I don't want to use them." I said, "Yes, you do, you just don't know you want to use them." And at that time, really, he said, "Okay." You know, but what he was really saying was, "Fuck off, man." But I didn't know that.
Was the argument about the unicorn of Sebastian's when you challenged Ridley to a duel?
No. That was way after that. That was after I'd come back for a moment.
Okay, we'll get to that later. I love that early idea, but Ridley was pitching you the chess game. And you wanted to do a unicorn as a way into Tyrell. What did you not like about the chess game when he was pitching it
to you? I just didn't think it was feasible. I just thought the Tyrell and this little Sebastian guy, I mean, it's going to, "Oh yeah, come up, I want to see what you're going to do with a chess move." We know we can get into Tyrells, including these genius, you know, androids. I just didn't go for it. And he was right. Like he always was. I mean, really, in all his arguments, was right. And I was always wrong, although I didn't know it at the time.
You're a young writer.
I wasn't young, I was old.
You were an old writer. Older than me, all right. Tell me this. What was something that you really enjoyed experiencing about Ridley Scott's creative habits?
I loved it. Ridley, from the get-go, and I guess still do, he was inspiring. He was awesome. Really awesome. His idea, I mean... I always say osmotically he conveys something. And he does it with actors too. I mean, this like good directors do. You catch a virus from them, and you can't stop. You know. Hello.
We're gonna get to David right now. Ultimately, creative differences happen on plenty of projects. When did you realize that after all the drafts that you've done, after all the collaboration with Ridley and the producers, when did you realize that you were off?
Blade Runner. Well, I didn't know I was off. I mean, that was the tricky part. I was invited to dinner by his associate producer, Ivor Powell. And we're having dinner, and I think it was Christmas, I don't remember. But he put a script in front of me. And I just thought it was another script being put in front of me, like, what do you think of this, Fancher? And I looked at it, first page, and it was an interesting scene of a junk pile of replicants off-world. And I was like, wow, that's nice. And I turned the page, and all of a sudden it was the interview with Holden. And I realized what that was. I went,
you betrayed me.
Did you give notes? Were they giving you that script to have notes?
No. Yeah. Ivor was giving me that script to say, I told you so.
Got it.
You know, like, you know, here's what's happening. And Ridley doesn't tell it that way, of course. One of us is lying.
Or has implanted memories. It could be either. David, you were working with Ridley's brother, Tony Scott, on My Dog's on Fire, a project that you guys were looking to do, and that's kind of what brought you into, I think, Ridley's realm. What do you remember about coming on to Blade Runner and the way that you found it when you came on?
Well, my first glimpse, I guess you'd say, of Blade Runner was there was a screening of the original Mad Max somewhere, and Tony said, my brother's screening the original Mad Max, let's go see it. And so he took me to this theater, and he introduced me to this guy Ridley, right? I knew who Ridley was, and a duelist and alien. And I met him, and Ridley, he's kind of a gruff guy and everything. So I met him, and in the background, down in the seats, were these Hollywood types. Now, years later, I realized, oh, that was Hampton Fancher in that cool jacket. And that was the beautiful Kate Haber, who's sitting right there. She's the mother of Blade Runner. She made the whole thing happen.
Give another Kate.
Okay, Kate. That was the Blade Runner crowd. So I knew Blade Runner was going on, but I had no part in it. And then I finished for Tony, and I drove home, and I got home to Berkeley, and there's a phone call for me, and I learned that Ridley Scott wants to talk to me about doing a rewrite on Blade Runner. And I go, whoa, right? I had no credits. I was a nobody. And so I went down there, and they put me in this suite at the Chateau Marmont. Okay. And they sent over this script to read. So I read the script. And to this day, I don't know. You have to understand, I was 40 years old, but I was green. I didn't know any of the things you guys know about the movie business. So, I've been a film editor, but that's different, right? So I read this script, and either... And again, I don't know to this day, by instinct or just by honesty, when they came over and said, well, what did you think, right? I said, wow, this is a fantastic script. There's nothing I could do to help you. I couldn't make this better. And I learned right then what I since learned that producers, when they work on a script and they have writers go through it, they get very proud of it. It's like their little kid. And they don't want you to come in and tell them how ugly their kid is, right? And say, I can fix it, I can make it better. But for me, it was kind of despair because I really would like this job, but there was nothing like this script was so good. And it was not just, part of it was the visionary thing of Hampton channeling Philip K. Dick, that's wonderful. But Hampton's prose is awesome. I mean, really, really great. And if you don't believe me, you can go get his book, Shape of the Final Dog, and read how he writes. People don't write screenplays in that language. I mean, it was just when he says that Deckard did the one push-up you can't do, I can't say it right because I can't say it as well as he did. The writing was exquisite. So here I am with this. Well, they chuckle, right? And Michael Dealey says, well, Ridley has a few ideas of his own, right? And I was being hired to do a production rewrite, but I didn't know what a production rewrite was. I'd always been a guy who sat in a room and wrote original scripts, and I was the king. This was my vision, this was my world, this was my stuff. Now what I had was, I was coming in to do what Ridley wanted. Now he gave me a lot of room and let me do a lot of things, you know, on my own and everything. That was fine. But basically, my job was to move the script in the direction Ridley wanted. And sometimes it hurt because I thought Hampton's script was just fine. And he wanted to introduce things like he was deeply into that photograph, going inside the photograph, the clue thing and everything. And that was so important to him. So it was basically a set piece. And now we were writing to get to a set piece, which is a very clumsy way to tell a story. So I was frustrated by that. But Ridley was turning it into something different. Now, like Hampton, at that time, Ridley's charismatic, like Ridley and everything, but he also is maddening, right? Because he doesn't think or talk narrative, and he's, or at least he didn't then, and so on. And so on the one hand, I was thrilled to be on this picture. On the other hand, I was beginning to get like Hampton was getting, because we were changing things in very strange ways. With hindsight, I appreciate Ridley much, much more. He knew much more than I thought he'd do, and he really was doing the right thing. But at the time, I would get very frustrated. He'd have some new idea. I'd knock it out, write it all out, and I'd come over to take it to the set for him to read. But no, he'd moved on to another idea. He wasn't interested in that one anymore. So it would make you kind of crazy sometimes.
Well, he had plenty of ideas. And it's interesting that you bring up the Esper machine, the zooming in of the photograph, as a set piece. I'm curious what it looks like on the page. And were you working with storyboard artists on a scene like that?
Because it's so visual. One of the great storyboard artists, Sherman Lobby, was on it. And I've saved some of the storyboards from that because what an artist he was. That stuff is worthy of framing. It's so great.
What do you mean, why is he still here?
No, he died. His stuff was it evoked stuff, as art does. In terms of... what did you ask?
The Esper scene, the photograph.
Yeah, I did not see that. And in fact, I remember, I didn't see any of it. I didn't understand all these. I knew there was something from the off world up there and stuff. I had no idea of the vision of Blade Runner. And it wasn't really that what was on the page. And I remember Ridley coming out of a meeting. We'd driven over somewhere at Warner Brothers, and he was really frustrated because these guys didn't have any imagination. They couldn't understand what the hell he was talking about. And I said, geez, Ridley, I'm this dystopian writer and all this shit. I have a clue. indeed, when I saw the cut of Blade Runner, I was boggled. And Hampton said, I don't want my name on that piece of shit, right? And I thought, oh, fuck, I hope I get my name on it.
You know, there's always... There was so many ideas floating around. I think one of the interesting scenes, I went to the Academy Library, the Margaret Herrick Library, and the Writers Guild Foundation Library, and I looked at early drafts from both of you from Blade Runner. And one of the scenes that was kind of interesting was, you know, there was a lost scene of Deckard meeting up with Leon at a bar. And
the cockroach.
And Leon had a cockroach. And that was kind of the way that they met. It wasn't after Zora's death. And I'm curious what you remember about writing that scene, because we're gonna publish an excerpt of it in Backstory. But it was a great scene.
I gotta talk about that scene. That was one of the scenes that was in from Hampton's draft. I hadn't touched it. I didn't like it. I didn't get it. I didn't think it was a good scene. I loved a lot of Hampton's script. That scene was the one that was weakest and of no interest to me and everything. But it was still in the script when we did the table read. And when the actors read that scene, it came alive, and it was magic, and it was funny. And only then did I get what Hampton had written. It wasn't for me on the page. It was you knew what the actors were going to do.
Well, something that I recommend, that particular scene, other scenes too, but that particular scene was arrived at, if you guys are writers, aspiring directors, whatever, that was arrived at as a writer by getting a couple of actors and took them to a very sequestered place, a little Airstream trailer, and had them improvise that scene over and over again. Sandy and Michael and a bartender, a woman. Anyway, did that a bunch of times and was taking notes, and I'd give them another direction and they'd improvise another thing, and that's how, you know, and I arrived at that scene organically, as opposed to his foolishness.
I don't know why it came out. I had nothing to do with taking it out, because once I heard it read in that read-around, I was totally behind it. You know.
It was a great scene. When you came on, David, did Ridley want you to read the book to get up to speed?
No, I asked him if I should, and he said, nah, don't bother. I had no eagerness to read the book, so there we were. And besides that, Hampton...
Wait, sorry, Hampton, what did you say?
Ridley never read the book.
Ridley never read the book.
So, no, Hampton... What I was doing is I was working on something that Hampton had done, and Hampton had written God knows how many drafts. Only Kate Haber knows how many drafts he wrote. And I would be in a story meeting. I remember specifically having this happen. We're sitting in a story meeting. Well, how are we going to solve this issue? We're all sitting around the table. And I said, well, you know, I can't remember what I said. I said, Deckard could or something like that. And Kate says, oh, I think I remember that draft that Hampton did, right? So it was all there in the archive. We weren't going anywhere. We just going back to whatever, you know, was previous.
Having talked to both of you, that's the kind of the most interesting thing about Ridley on this project, was that he was continually challenging the story for the wildest ideas from both of you and giving you new ideas over and over, just seeing if any of them could work.
True.
And he just wasn't a man that was content until he had expired seemingly every possibility.
How many renditions of that film have been cut?
Right, exactly.
But I mean, that's the power of Ridley. Who would have the balls or the insanity to do that? I mean, to keep changing things and say, here, I want you, tomorrow, you come in with a description of this checkered shirt. Okay, I come, yeah, I got the perfect checkered shirt. Yeah, what about the shoes? You know, it was always changing. And finally I said,
One of the things for both of you guys to talk about, you know, at the heart of the film is this interesting relationship between Deckard and Rachel. In which, you know, he's basically blowing her off in the beginning of the movie and falling for her by the end. And it's kind of, you know, we're seeing a little of the humanity between them. And I'm just kind of curious what the challenge is and what the different versions of it were. Hampton, starting with you, when you were kind of putting it on the page between Deckard and Rachel, what were some of the important tropes that were there for you?
I don't understand the question.
Writing.
I mean, you can repeat it, but I still don't understand it.
Think of it this way. Writing a relationship between, for when you were writing it, because it changed later, a human and a replicant.
That was the first iteration. Like a human and a replicant. It was somebody after somebody to expose somebody, and somebody who didn't want something exposed or was defensive, was uptight about it. And how could she elegantly and nobly defend herself against this onslaught of this guy trying to get into her purse, so to speak? And so, I mean, it was just like writing any scene. I mean, in the sense that there was some opposition, some conflict of interest and all that, and you had a character in mind, in both cases, definite people. And so, I said the word people, right?
David, what were some of the challenges you had maintaining the Deckard-Rachel relationship?
Well, I don't know. I don't think I was that sensitive a guy. He's a sensitive one, right? I'm the animal. But I just sort of saw it as that I thought, and this is something that just seemed to be coming through. I don't know if it originated with Dick, but I have a feeling it did, right? That it had something to do with racism. And it had something to do with Deckard's problem. And Deckard had a rule that this woman wasn't human. And therefore, according to that rule, he couldn't be attracted to her. And yet, grudgingly, he was. And that meant he had to ask himself a lot of questions or struggle with a lot of stuff.
But romantically, there's a principle, almost, some black magic going on there. We are, most of us, I think, attracted to things we shouldn't be attracted to. The dangerous, enigmatic, uncertain, and fall for the wrong guy, the wrong girl, whatever, made a lifetime of doing that, maybe you think. Well, why is that, I mean, there is something that humans do that way. They call it love and alcoholism.
there's the great scene with Tyrell and Roy Batty, and it's just a fantastic scene that is eloquent It's short. In any lesser hands between the both of you, it wouldn't have worked. And I'm just curious from both of you about the construction of that scene, because I know that you both contributed in different ways.
I don't think so. I think that was all him.
All him. Okay. Well, I know.
What scene? You're talking about the rooftop scene?
No. Between Dr. Tyrell and Roy Batty when he comes.
That scene wrote itself. I remember that scene. It was just easy. I don't know. I mean, it wasn't easy or hard. It just came out.
Sure.
You know, I don't know why.
Where'd you get all the scientific stuff?
And that's another thing I think Katie knows about, maybe. That stuff is just, I'm the opposite of scientific stuff. I don't know anything about any of that. But I made up words. You know, just as what do you call them, placekeepers or something like that?
Yeah, placeholders.
Yeah, placeholders. And I was just doing that. And then, okay, nobody's going to know the fucking difference. I'll let it. That's what it is. And then nobody noticed anything. Nobody said anything. Oh, but that's shit, you know. And then somebody went, took that scene to UCLA or something? Was that, did that have to do with you?
I don't think. And then
this, to check it out, whether that made sense to medical mentality or scientific mentality.
Well, absolutely.
Oh shit, we're lost. Yeah. No, I didn't say that. I thought, oh good. And in my old intuition, you know, young, yeah.
Well, so David, there was something that I discovered in the Academy Library that I thought was kind of interesting, that was kind of a topper to that scene, in which, and we're gonna run an excerpt on backstory for this as well, in which basically the minute Tyrell's dead body hits the floor, Roy turns to Sebastian and says, "Where's the real Dr. Tyrell? This thing couldn't have created you, let alone me." And he forces Sebastian to get a key card out, and they go down a long, strange marble hallway to a strange secret room, and I'll let you take it from there if you remember it.
No, I don't remember that. I remember Ridley saying, "Wouldn't it be great if it was cryogenic?" And I point out, this was before Chrome Yellow or whatever. I thought, oh, I was so boring, these cryogenic scenes that I'd seen. I said, no, the way Tyrell is preserved is in the body of a shark swimming in a tank with a bunch of sensors coming out, and they can get Tyrell's mind through these sensors and translate it out so you hear the shark's thoughts as it swims through the tank.
It's so crazy.
Later on, that came out in a Gibson picture, sort of. And so on, but I thought it was brilliant. Ridley didn't jump on it. Some things Ridley jumped on, some things he didn't.
He couldn't entice him with the shark computer
didn't work
version.
For it, no.
Well, what's interesting, the version that I found wasn't even the shark version. It was that they get in there, Tyrell's on ice, and Roy's insisting he be woken up, and Sebastian's explaining how, oh, no, we can't wake him up.
I
can cause damage.
Or something like that.
Right, and then it turns out that Sebastian messed up, human error, and Tyrell's actually in a coma.
Okay, I think I remember.
He's dead.
I think I remember something like that. And this, but again, this was Ridley's idea that he'd be a cryogenic thing, and so we pursued it, I guess. I think I vaguely remember.
Were sets ever built? Was it ever going to be shot?
No, that was the thing. I remember early on the picture, I needed a scene to do something dialogically or whatever it was, and I wanted Deckard to take a piss, and Ivor went, "Sir, you can't build a new set. We built the sets." And I'm saying, "A urinal, right?" And no, but it was out of the question. So building new things didn't happen too much because it was all being built. At least by the time I came on, there were cars, there was all sorts of stuff. So they were very committed to the picture, even though the funding folded around Christmas. Anyway.
And the producers actually paid your fee to keep you on writing while they were searching for new funding, is that right?
They sent me off before Christmas, and they cobbled together from Hampton's drafts and mine, they put together their own cut-and-paste version, which then got the picture financed again, but not immediately. So I went home for Christmas thinking, oh, it was a great ride, but it's all over now, right? And then after Christmas, sometime in January, Michael Dealey explained they'd bring me back and they'd pay me, Michael and Ridley out of their own pockets would pay me half my pay and the rest would be deferred until they got it funded again. And I jumped at that. Half my pay was more than I'd ever made in my life. So I came back, and then indeed they did get the picture funded. I came back, and this is an interesting story about for people who write, and I've been writing since 1993. There, David Peoples stopped being a writer, and David and Janet Peoples became a writer. She'd been a writer before, I was a writer before, then we became this other voice, and we worked together all the time.
And the amazing Janet Peoples is sitting right there in the front row, ladies and gentlemen, so please give her a round of applause.
So what I was going to say is, after Christmas, I came back, and I don't know if this was the day, but this is I'll just throw this in as a side. I came in one day to see Michael in his office, and I think they were supposed to be meeting with Ridley, and I said, "Where's Ridley?" And Michael said, Harrison Ford took him out last night. Harrison wanted to break the ice. And I hope. Michael looks over and he says, break down the barriers. He wanted to break down the barriers. And Michael Bailey looked a little pained and he said, "You know, we British rather like the barriers." So anyway, what happened at this somewhere in this point, Michael Dealey said to me, "Ridley really loves something from this old draft of Hamptons, and he wants you to get it in there." And it was some of the stuff from the end of the picture, or the big fight in the warehouse, or something like that, in the abandoned building. And he gave it to me. And, you know, I'd been on the picture, Hampton had been off the picture, right? I take this draft that Hampton had written before he was off the picture, and I start reading it. And there's stuff in there that I swear to God I'd written, right? And I go, "Oh, now what can happen when you're rewriting stuff? You lose track of who's done what." When Janet and I write, we pass it back and forth over and over again until something starts out as Janet's idea or my idea. By the time we're done, we have no idea who did that or where it came from or who thought of it. And here it is. I'm saying, "Oh, I fooled myself. I didn't write all this new stuff. Shoulder of Orion must have been Hampton, right?" And everything. And I'm thinking, but I had been, from the very beginning, trying to write in Hampton's voice. I so admired his writing. And I was trying to write, like I said, well, geez, at any rate. And then afterwards, I found out, no, Hampton had been writing over Christmas. And this was Hampton rewriting me. And then, in fact, I had remembered some. I had put in some of that stuff that was in there. And this was Ridley getting Hampton back to work to fix up something that I hadn't done right. And so, but at any rate, the time there where I actually thought that Hampton had invented a bunch of stuff that I swore I invented, but then I accepted it. And I said, "No, I just misremembered it. It was all him, and I must have, you know."
Well, to confuse matters, as you said, they did a cut draft where they were piecing together, copying and pasting stuff from both of you. Hampton, you know, the concept of never truly being off a project, when it, especially you, my friend, when it comes to Blade Runner, the 1982 version, or congrats on the 2049 version, which comes out this week.
That's a good one.
Because you carried the torch on that to start the project as well. What was it like to come back to Blade Runner over that Christmas break and to kind of reconcile or not with Ridley?
At that point, I don't remember.
You don't remember? Okay.
No.
Do you remember some of the things that they needed? Was it the night shoots on the rooftop? Was it that?
No, I remember coming back at the very end.
Okay, for that.
It was the night shoot, just basically David's work. I don't think they gave me anything. I saw that hadn't been shot yet, but I saw footage all day long, and I wrote a scene over a night shoot myself. Shoot myself in the head all night long with cocaine, and then in the morning I came back with a scene, and there was I wrote my version of that scene, which wasn't used. Basically, it was David, and then
we're talking about the Roy Batty death.
Yeah, Roy. I mean, Rutger Hauer came up with a definitive line, I think, or two, that are, you know, immortal kind of, and I wrote. Almost landing and saying, "Yeah, but who does live forever on that ship?" And but basically, it was David, I think.
Which is awesome, because you guys were collaborating without even knowing.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't know anything.
And at the same time, David, I mean, I know you said this story in the documentary, but it's just so great that you had been working on the Roy Batty death speech, And it was close, but not exact. But then something changed for you during the table read.
Oh, no, that was way at the beginning of shooting. And I had the speech in there. I think it's the one about Shoulder of Orion and stuff, what I've seen. And that, when I left before Christmas, I think that scene was in the lab, right, where he's talking about the things I've seen with your eyes, right? But at any rate, whatever. It was back at the end, and I thought it was really good and working really well where it had been moved to. And then, as we're going around the table, and it comes to read that speech, Rutger reads it, and then he adds these two lines about tears in the rain. And then he puts up like a naughty schoolboy, like, looks at me, like, ooh. this is a big-time actor and stuff, and I'm just this nebbish writer. I wasn't going to object to what he wanted to say, even though I thought it was terrible, and I was really upset. Like any writer, when you change even a word, and as I say, Janet and I collaborate, and boy, do we go at each other. You change that. Why is that different, right? And then I'll go back and find it's exactly what I wrote, but and vice versa. But at any rate, in this case, he added those two lines, and I thought they were soppy and no good. But over the years, I've learned to really love them. They really are good lines.
The best two lines in the movie.
Well, Harrison Ford made up a whole bunch of the other stuff, you know.
Not the stuff I wrote.
Finding the ending was something that changed a lot, Hampton. And in the research that I did, you know, there was obviously your draft where at one point Deckard retired Rachel, at one point Rachel committed suicide off screen, a gunshot rings out. There was even the draft that you and director Robert Mulligan were going around with, to my memory, before Ridley was on, that had the tortoise ending. And the tortoise concept turned out to be part of the Voight-Kampff test in the beginning. So
why I got the idea, I think. Right. I mean, in retrospect, I think that when I came up with the turtle idea, I run into a turtle in the desert and had a time with that shitting turtle.
And it was turned over on its back?
Yeah. And because when he shit on me, I threw him out of the car. I kept him taking him home. And then I looked in the rearview mirror and he was lying on his back. And I'm like, fuck him, I hate him anyway. So I went back and turned him over. And he didn't care. So the tortoise was in there. And I don't know when I came up with that, but I just went in, you know, one of those acid trips in the Mojave.
And Robert Mulligan liked that ending.
We were Universal then, and we were Robert Mulligan, and they had optioned it or something, and they didn't want that. They wanted a happy ending. And I didn't want to do it. And Michael and you guys were with me, I think, but they wanted a happy ending. And then Mulligan said, fucking give it to them. And I'll go back to the original, shoot the original, they'll see the mistake, and it'll be fine. I said, well, how will you shoot it? And he said, don't worry, I've got it. I can do that. I'm that powerful, you know. I can do that. I won't tell him, but I'll shoot this, because I love it too, Hampton. And he took the tortoise. And so I said, I don't know if you can do that. I don't think that'll work, man. I think we got to get their approval of this or not do it, because it's not. He said, if I can't do it, then I should hang up my jock.
It's kind of a good mic drop statement. So when Ridley came on, what did he think of the tortoise?
He pretended to like it a little bit, but he wasn't going for it.
He wasn't going for it.
No.
Ooh, hey, I'm cutting in really quick to remind you all about my digital magazine, Backstory. It's an iPad magazine that focuses on the art and business of storytelling. Currently, we're an iPad-only magazine and also available on Google Play on other tablets, but fear not, we're coming to the web very soon. You could check out www.backstory.net for updates. As I said earlier, our servers have been transferred, we're in final testing, and it's all looking really great, so you will finally be able to read Backstory on the web very soon. One important thing to remember about Backstory is that when you subscribe on on the web, you'll get access to every single issue we've ever published, so you'll be in the loop on everything. My team has put a lot of work into our new issue number 29, with Blade Runner 2049 cover stories that include in-depth interviews from writers Hampton Fancher and Michael Green on this utterly fantastic marvel of a film. In fact, some of Hampton's article includes explanations of moments and scenes that were scripted but never shot for Blade Runner 2049, so that's fascinating stuff as well. There's also plenty more stuff from Hampton Fancher and David Webb Peoples regarding the original Blade Runner, including script excerpts that you could read that I researched at the Margaret Herrick Academy Library and the Writers Guild Foundation Library as well. In issue 29, you could also read the entire Blacklist screenplay Bare Knuckle, plus an interview with its writer, David Mateo. Issue 29 also features actor-writer Danny McBride and director David Gordon Green chatting about writing season 2 of HBO's darkly hilarious Vice Principals. We also have actor Jason Isaacs chatting about taking the captain's chair in Star Trek Discovery, actor George Griffiths on playing Rey in Twin Peaks: The Return, directors Dayton Ferris on Battle of the Sexes, director Andy Muschietti on the horror hit It, screenwriter Jason Hall on Thank You for Your Service, and so much more to explore. Remember, if you have an iPad or any tablet with Google Play, the app and issue 1 are both still free, and each individual issue costs less than a beer at a hipster bar. So treat yourself. And after you treat yourself, don't forget to use discount coupon code QAPODCAST, all one word, for both of our sponsors. Over at screencraft.org, QAPODCAST will save you 10% on a screenwriting fellowship or any screenwriting competition entry fees. Or over at finaldraft.com, QAPODCAST will save you 30% on your screenwriting software purchase. Look, I really appreciate you supporting our sponsors and considering spreading the word about my passion project going live soon at www.backstory.net. But now, let's jump right back into my conversation with screenwriters Hampton Fancher and David Webb Peoples to hear more about their passion project, Blade Runner.
I'm curious for both of you, the moment when Ridley pitched the concept of Deckard being a replicant and the incorporation of the unicorn iconography, the origami of it, the implanted dream. Hampton, was that something that was discussed when you were on early on?
It was disgusting to me. I didn't like the unicorn. Or what's it called?
Origami.
I didn't like that.
So was that one of the things?
I was wrong about everything.
Was that one of the things that you and Ridley refused to write for?
Well, I didn't refuse. I just said, that's not right. And Ridley would just go on the next thing. It wasn't like there was a big argument about the unicorn, although he did have a way of returning to things always. He was persistent. And I thought we discussed that yesterday. I thought we discussed that last week. Now it came up again, I said, I don't like it. I don't think it's a good idea. Here's why, whatever. The unicorns always bothered me, especially on postcards.
Also, by the end of the movie that was released in 82, and David, I want to get your opinion on that in a second, but when it came out, that scene was not there, Hampton. Those scenes were not there. The 1982 release version is really skewed that Deckard is human. And so when the director's cut came out and then the final cut came out, how has your views changed on it?
I'm telling you, really finally gets his way always.
That's the way it is. That's the way it needs to be. David, what do you remember about being pitched?
I remember when I came on, the draft that Hampton had, Rachel, the gunshot off screen, I thought it was beautiful. I thought it was terrific. Ridley started telling me, we can't have that because there was this European film, French maybe, I'm not sure, with a lot of classical music.
Italian.
Maybe, I don't know. But it was something where it had a suicide in the end or something, and Ridley thought, it's too mimics that picture. Now, nobody, even I can't remember what that picture was.
The Conformist? The Conformist.
No, it was not the Conformist.
Oh, Cameron.
No, it was some slightly, it was a brief European hit with a lot of Mozart or something.
Elvira Madigan.
That's it.
The 25th piano.
Okay, he was, say Schopenhauer. He said this too much. I hadn't seen Elvira Madigan, but Ridley said no, this is too much like Elvira Madigan, we can't have that. And so I had written some variations. I'd had a different Thing theme in the voiceover about choice and stuff, and I put it into the ending and then said Rachel went off and killed herself, she had a choice, et cetera, et cetera. And did some other stuff. And that ending, I think, went the way of endings. And then there was this thing with them in the countryside using all the footage of the Kubrick horror picture. And a lot of voiceover.
And we'll get to that in 1 second.
It was kind of, the whole thing was not under control, which always makes writers nervous.
And it was, but it was interesting because it kept changing. It was fluid, like the whole process. I don't know if you guys are familiar with this, but it seems like from when I talked to you before, you hadn't actually read this. There's a book that came out a couple years ago called Philip K. Dick's Last Interview. And one of the things that I found really interesting from it was that before he died, he never got to see the movie, but before he died, he had actually read drafts from both of you that the studio had sent them. And he started confusing which draft he liked better between the both of you.
He hated mine from the beginning. He loved his.
Right. He favored David's, but he was not understanding that some of the things that he was reading was even your rewrites on David and vice versa. So I get to quote with David.
Yeah, I was going to say I have a strong feeling about that, which I can't prove or anything, but I have an instinctive feeling that Philip K. Dick got Hampton's draft and saw somebody fucking with his work. And any writer knows what that feels like. That hurts. And that's, you react to it like an animal or something. And he was outraged, and I think he made some enemies with the production and everything. And then somebody sends him a draft by me, and now he wants to like the movie, and he's gotten over the fact that it's gonna be changed or something. So my personal belief is, what it means is, if you'd given him my draft first, he would have been outraged. And then he sees Hampton's draft, and he would have loved it. I mean, I think that he was dealing with somebody fucking with his work that was very personal to him, and I totally understand and respect that, because I'm a writer too, and I would feel the same way.
Well, I'm going to let the man himself speak. In 1981, he was doing an interview with James Van Heist that was in the book, and I found a quote that's exactly what we're talking about, in which even Philip K. Dick couldn't decide what he thought about the concept of Deckard being a replicant, because that's not the way it was in his novel. And he said, quote, "So you have Deckard becoming more and more dehumanized, and the replicants becoming more human. And at the end of the story, they meet, and the distinction is gone. This is not a victory where the replicants become humanized, and there is some victory by humanity over inhumanity. This is horrifying, because he is now as they are. So the theme of the novel is completely and essentially retained." And I think him saying that his thematic was retained, even though you guys changed it around, was kind of him giving you a vote of confidence. Because at the end of the day, in the rest of that interview, he does speak highly of the draft and says that he thinks that from both of you, and he decided that it was an intelligent adaptation of his book, and that the book could be the book and the film could be the film. Getting to the happy ending, because that was the way that you guys left this project before the director's cut and the final cut, it seemed extremely chaotic with all the voiceover that you were doing as the test screenings were coming back. Because both of you were writing voiceover at the same time, trying to clarify things that the audience was worried about. And I'm just curious what you remember from that period of voiceover, Hampton, because that was another time that you would come back on to Blade Runner yet again.
Yeah, in post, yeah. I guess it was post.
What do you remember about trying to clarify things from Deckard's voiceover or fill some of the space?
I'm happy to say absolutely nothing.
David? I would just say we both had written, I thought, really good voiceover. I had done some rewriting to get something I wanted into it, but not because Hampton's stuff wasn't terrific. I was trying to do something a little different, and I worked on it. So we both had good voiceovers. And I said, at some point, I think we got to take all the voiceover off before you shoot, because the script should read so that it works. This voiceover is supposed to be like music. It's supposed to be an addition and a help to the movie, but not a crutch for the movie. The voiceover was taken off, shot the movie. Now the movie has all sorts of problems that have come about in the course of production, of changes and things like that. And all of a sudden, the voiceover is required as a crutch. And now Hampton and I both took turns trying to fix that. We didn't know the other one was doing it at the time. Once again, we were separate and so on. But then one day there's this cast and crew screening and Hampton says, come on, come on, you got to see the movie, right? So I came down. By then we knew each other. We met each other in sometime after that. Now the picture's coming out. We don't know what's going on. We went down there to see the movie and we both watched it. And I guess he'd seen it the night before, so he knew what he was seeing. And there were many, I mean, wonderful surprises for me. I hadn't known the Vangelis music would work that way. That whole opening just blew my mind. And there was all sorts of really good stuff in it. The voiceover was terrifying because there was in it some of the good stuff Hampton had written, and there was some of the good stuff I'd written, and then there was some garbage that was just so bad that it made you cringe. So I assumed, okay, well, Hampton must have written it, but now I knew Hampton must have done it because that's what you do. The director wants this, the producer wants this, you do it, right? It's a professional thing, you have to do it. It's not Hampton's fault. I won't say anything nasty to Hampton here. And so I learned later, Hampton was thinking the same thing. He didn't want to hurt my feelings about what shit I'd written. And it turned out somebody else had come on during the time that Ridley was fired, and they brought in people to do all this explaining and stuff. I don't even know that Ridley had much to do with that voiceover, but
it was third parties. They basically new writers brought in on top of the writers.
And it was a difficult situation. Voiceover wasn't going to solve the things that, I mean, suddenly the realization was come to at some point, oh my God, the leading lady has to die. Right? Well, that was the premise of the movie. I mean, and you're stuck with that. And now, because it's a movie, everybody's trying to figure out a way that the leading lady doesn't die. And, you know, that was a hopeless thing. Hampton had it right the first time. He had it right with the suicide off camera. It was beautiful.
I think it was in the book, maybe.
What if you wrote a line for Deckard in the voiceover where he was talking about how Roy Batty was his brother? And I was curious if you could...
Roy Batty's my combat brother, right?
Yeah.
Well, what do you mean by... That's a very interesting thing because... And this is, again, me just... I think this is what happened, but I don't know, right? All of a sudden, at some point during the rewrites, and I was writing out these drafts fast and doing all this stuff, Ridley became very effusive and said to me, "Peoples, you're such a heady metal writer and stuff." And Ridley's not... He's a wonderful man and terrific, but he's not always giving a lot of praise, right? And so I was shocked. I'm heavy metal, cool. And so and that all went by, and I didn't know anything about it, and the movie came out. And some years later, I'm going through old drafts, and I found these drafts where I'd had Deckard at the end of the movie mulling over what it all meant, right? And if... You know, and he made these references to, you know, what's the difference between me and Batty? You know, I mean, he's got a termination date. I got a termination date. He was made by Terrell. I don't know who made me, but we're, and so on, and stuff like that. And then I'm just kind of a combat model like Roy Batty was and stuff. And it was basically, I thought, what the theme of the book was in many ways, that, you know, what's a human being? Well, I guess Batty and me are both the same thing and so on. So that's all I thought it was. I didn't think for a minute that Deckard was a replicant. But as I read it several years later, I'm going, it says Deckard is a replicant, even if that isn't what I meant. And I realize, oh, I wonder if that was, you know, from me that Ridley suddenly said, ha, Deckard's a replicant. And now maybe not. Ridley may have been way ahead. He was a sharp guy, but... Was he Deckard a replicant back when you were working on it?
He was never a replicant in my estimation.
Okay, well, in this case, I may be the culprit who suggested it by accident. It's possible.
Well, there was always a possibility.
Are you saying in your mind that Deckard is human?
Am I saying in my mind?
Are you saying in your draft?
I said, right out of here.
Are you saying
he's not a replicant any more than you are, unless maybe you are?
It's
a bit ambiguous, you know? I always said one thing, I'm so sick of saying it.
When the cat's out of the bag, the game is over.
Let's keep the cat in the bag. You see Lebanon? Question mark.
What did you guys think when you saw the director's cut for the first time with a voiceover that you both hated ripped out of it? What was your reaction to that? And then we'll bring up Kate.
My reaction to voiceover out. Relief.
Just like all my, very mixed, because every time I was seeing the movie, I was seeing all the stuff that was good that was gone, and all the stuff that was different, and I missed a lot of the voiceover, but I was glad to hear the bad stuff out, and I thought there had been many versions that were better than having the no voiceover, but the no voiceover was better than the one with all the bad stuff. So it's just, there's so many scenes, I mean, there's so many versions of that movie. And I can't even see the movie. I saw it once, like I was a person watching a movie and could see the movie. But most of the time, all I see are the scenes that aren't there, the missing, oh, that's in there now. Or, oh, what happened to whatchamacallit? It's just an ongoing puzzle.
Right. One second, just one little moment. You want to see the movie a bunch of times, I mean, us. But my favorite time to see the movie was in David's house in Berkeley. And Janet and David and I, many years ago, they just got a thing called, I think, a flat screen TV or some weird thing, you know, I never saw it before. And let's go in there in the bedroom and lay down and watch that for a little while and see what it looks like. And the three of us in bed. Santa coming?
Yeah, I remember it.
Come on, it sounds cozy. All right, we're going to bring a chair up and we're going to bring up Kate. Give it up for Kate. As we've been talking, Kate, what's something that you remember that you heard that sparked your memory as
what's that? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Well, first of all, it was Roland Kibbe who wrote
I saw his name somewhere, right?
Roland Kibbe wrote the voiceover together with Bud Yorkin. And Bud Yorkin and I've had the pleasure of directing Harrison doing the voiceover, and he hated it so much he did it really, really badly, just so it wouldn't be used, and it was. And we really called it Irving the Explainer. And but the whole Decca being a replicant thing actually stemmed from a mistake in the shoot.
What was the mistake?
The mistake was. That, you know, when he comes back and he's taking the drink and he's spitting the blood in the thing, right. And she walks into shot, and we have a special red light, to reflect it in her eyes, which manifested the fact that she was a replicant. Harrison walked into the shot by mistake, and Ridley kept shooting. And by walking into the shot, his eyes also had the red reflection in it. And Ridley kept it. And honestly, the whole idea of Deckard being a replicant stemmed from that mistake on the shoot and left that enigma for everybody else to work out. So that's the truth.
The lighting, not the writing.
So that all stemmed from that, and you know, people have been sort of giving psychological reasons and yes and no and all the rest of it, but it was a simple shoot mistake.
Just before we get a question from the crowd, what do you remember as the strangest audience note when you guys were doing test screenings? The most frustrating thing for you that you were seeing?
You know, I don't remember because it was so frustrating. I just wiped it out. But there's one, you're talking about the happy ending. I actually shot the happy ending as a second unit. And when it was Ridley sent, you know, Ridley was, everybody was off the picture except me. And I Ridley said, I want you to go to Moab, Utah, and I want you to shoot the happy ending. He didn't call it the happy ending. So me and a cinematographer were up in a helicopter for about 8 hours in Moab, Utah. And it was freezing cold. It was totally, you couldn't see a thing from the helicopter down because it was snowing and foggy and all the rest of it. And that whole shoot was totally unacceptable. And I failed miserably. But it wasn't my fault. But I came back and I said, you know, you're not going to see anything. And you didn't. And that's when he called up Kubrick and he said, you know, The Shining, could we possibly have some of your outtakes? And that's what happened. But I was second unit director on the happy ending.
It's just for geeks, it's always been a funny ending when they're you know, driving in this beautiful countryside. And everybody's like, well, why is everybody living in the city if it's an hour away?
We could have moved on to Utah and we wouldn't have to make this film in the first place.
We need to go off world. We're gonna take one or two quick questions from the crowd, and then we're out of time. You start in the half.
No, I got it.
The title of the film.
Exclamation. It was like play money, man. Someone just asked me, a journalist, how to write it, you know, type of. It was quite a while. It was a couple of months. And Katie and Ivor and Ridley and I, and Ridley said, all of a sudden, what is this guy? What is he? And I said, well, he's a detective. Come on, man, let's go. And he said, but what kind of detective? And it's, you know, like looking for a name. A rubric. And so I said, well, I don't know, he's a detective. That's not good enough. And you better come up with something fast. And so that night, I looked through, I was desperate looking through stuff, and I kind of vaguely remembered a William Burroughs little book I had. It's called The Blade Runner.
Yeah.
And so I thought, whoa, that's it. So then I said, I came in the next day, I said, what about Blade Runner? Everybody said, yay! later, we were looking for a title because there were androids, you know, like the sheep, which I loved. It was not a good title, you know, blah blah blah. So we had all these various titles, and then finally Michael Dee said, "It's looking us in the face." And he said, right, no, the title. What it means? It meant doing something very dangerous.
Were there ever any plans for Deckard to have an actual knife or use a knife? People have always asked over the years.
A
blade, per se?
I thought he was talking.
No.
I'm going to get another question right there. What was your favorite scene to write, and did it end up in this version of the final cut? David, we'll start with you. What was your favorite scene to write? Whether or not it ended up in a film, doesn't matter.
I don't know. Maybe that stuff in the lab with Chew, or that some of which ended up in the end of the picture on the roof. I guess writing the roof was kind of fun. I have to put in my own word here, though, that to me, the scene that makes Blade Runner work is the Voight Kampff scene. That I did not touch a word of, and that scene is what makes Blade Runner take off and go. That was you. I don't know if you liked writing it or you didn't like writing it, but it was great.
I liked writing everything in Blade Runner before it. Before the monkey business started in Hollywood, you know, and I was all alone.
Hampton, what was your favorite scene for her question? What was your favorite scene to write?
I don't know. It'd take me a year or two to think of that, probably.
All right. Well, we'll reconvene in 2049. Look, you guys, it's late. You guys have been very generous with your time. I want you guys to give it up again for him.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Special thanks again to our host, the Los Angeles Film School, and our sponsors, ScreenCraft.org and FinalDraft.com. Remember, the same coupon discount code, QAPODCAST, all one word, QAPODCAST, will save you 10% off Screenwriting Fellowship entry fees and competition fees over at ScreenCraft.org. And that same discount code will get you 30% off your screenwriting software purchase over at FinalDraft.com. Don't pass up these cool deals. I would, of course, also like to thank screenwriters Hampton Fancher and David Webb Peoples, along with special guest Katie Haber, for being so generous with their time and coming down to chat about their experience creating the sci-fi classic Blade Runner. The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith is a copyright of Unlikely Films Incorporated in 2017. All rights reserved. And folks, I gotta thank you again for spreading the word about issue 29, our Blade Runner 2049 issue. And of course, get ready to read the entire magazine soon at backstory.net. And hey, if you'd like to show your support and donate to this free podcast so I can continue to buy new equipment and use these funds to pay for all my podcast hosting fees, feel free to send a PayPal virtual tip to Yo Goldsmith @gmail.com. Any amount is greatly appreciated. As for your social networking needs, you could follow Yo Goldsmith on Twitter or could check out my Facebook fan page. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, the publisher of Backstory and the host of the Q&A, thanking you for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.